Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. It has certainly been a challenging week, but here at Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we're focused on what's happening in our local food community, and there is so much going on that's positive. And we are celebrating an anniversary here at Eat, Drink, Indie. We've been on WFYI for 2 years now and are pretty excited to be going forward with more local food coverage. So this week on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we'll be hearing about some very cool things that are happening now. And we'll look back with a Cook This segment from our very first episode on WFYI from November 2014. First, we'll talk with local chef Anna Powell of Ivy Tech Community College, who tells us about how she typically spends her Thanksgiving holidays cooking for those in need. And this year, she'll be heading to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota to cook for the protesters. And since Thanksgiving is indeed coming right up, we'll also hear about a special event that takes place in Indianapolis the day after Thanksgiving on Black Friday, the release of Imperial Breakfast Magpie from New Day Craft. New Day's Tia Agnew tells us all about it. We'll also hear from Slow Food member and Milktooth co-founder Ashley Brooks about the new Garfield Park Farmers Market, which just wrapped up a successful first year. And from our very first show here on WFYI, we'll head into the kitchen with local chef Neil Brown at Pizzology and see how he cooks a pork chop in that 800-degree pizza oven. So stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. The upcoming Thanksgiving holiday will no doubt be filled with lots of cooking and good food. But one local Indianapolis chef won't be in a kitchen at a stove, but will be outdoors. And she won't be making a traditional turkey dinner either. Anna Powell of Ivy Tech Community College typically spends her holiday cooking for others, but this year she'll be doing that at Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Anna tells us how she decided to pack up her utensils and head west, what she'll be cooking, and how you can help.
I do something big every Thanksgiving. I try to do a service project. I believe that Thanksgiving is a time to spend with family and friends and cook really good food. And I also like to share my talent, which is culinary, with the community.
Right, because you're a chef, right?
I am a chef, yeah. So I and I do catering, so it kind of comes natural to me to cook for large amounts of people. It's pretty easy. So a few years ago, I started adopting places or people and cooking for them. And so this year, with everything that's going on with Standing Rock, I've just been compelled to do something more instead of just repost things or check in.
Right,
or
the Facebook activism that
we've
been seeing. Right?
Yeah, I want to do more for that community. And so I thought, what a better way than to go and maybe cook a big pot of soup for them or something that when they're out there, you know, protecting their land, they know that other people care about them and we're supporting them.
Well, no, that's very cool. So how do you just decide to go do that? I get the feeling like you've done these sorts of things.
Yeah. So not last year, but the year before, I started a GoFundMe campaign and adopted the Day Spring Center and cooked for the Day Spring Center. So over 50 homeless families, men and women, and their children. So, and then the year before that, I adopted a men's recovery shelter. I started doing this out of kind of, I would go volunteer somewhere, a soup kitchen, and I would be one of like 50 people standing there. And I didn't feel like I was best used. And, you know, everybody wants to volunteer over the holidays.
Sure.
And I thought, I know there are people that really need my help. And I just started doing something like this.
Yeah. So that it's not daunting as a chef. So it's not daunting to you to say, I'll just cook Thanksgiving dinner for 50 people.
No, not at all. It's really not. And it's only because that's what I do is catering. It'd be different maybe if I was a line chef only or, something like that. But I cook for 50 people all the time. So it's really, there's lots of moving parts. We do lots of offsite events. So it's just really not difficult for me.
So how did the idea to go to Standing Rock come about this year?
Well, like I said, just following the news. Well, not actually. There's not that much news, but more social media. And mm-hmm. just watching what these people are going through, I just kept feeling compelled to do something. And, I was going to go home for Thanksgiving and eat the normal Thanksgiving
sure.
meal and this year. And then I was actually driving to work. The day that I started my GoFundMe account for this. So it was on Tuesday. And I was driving to work and I call one of my best friends, Julia Harkle, and I said, you know what? I said, I've got this crazy idea. I think that I want to go to Standing Rock and cook Thanksgiving, cook a meal for them, not Thanksgiving dinner, but like a meal, soup or something like that, breakfast even, just cook meals for these people while they're out there protecting their land. And she's like, that's a great idea. And I said, I'm glad that you said that because I'd like you to go with me.
Oh, my goodness.
And I knew that she would go if I asked her to go. And so, yeah, that's how I was kind of born.
So you set up a GoFundMe account?
I did, yeah. So I went to work that day and I did my normal meetings in the morning and then I decided, you know what, I'm just going to start a GoFundMe account because I know it's going to cost quite a bit. I also want to be able to take some other supplies that are out there. There's a list that's been put out by the tribe of things that they need for the winter. So I thought, it's also a good way for people to get involved. So when people say, I want to do something around Thanksgiving or I want to do something for Standing Rock, it gives people an outlet to really feel like they are making an impact.
Now, what do you need? What are you hoping or planning to take with you? Got any specific things you're going to cook?
Yeah. So I think that I'm going to try to rent a 2-seater, just like U-Haul, 9-foot cargo van. That's what I would normally cater out of. So I'm going to take or rent one of those as long as I make enough money.
Right.
I'll rent one of those. And then I think I'm going to make beef stew for one of the meals. I'll probably make like biscuits and gravy for another. I'll make sure that I do some vegan and gluten-free options for the people that are there too. So maybe like a bean and squash soup. I just want hearty, simple meals that people know that I care about them.
Now tell me what you get out of doing this. You know, why do this?
Well, I have a personal mission statement to be of service, to be of maximum service to my fellow man. And so every single day I try to find ways that I can do that. Some days it's small, just by smiling at people or trying to best serve the students that I have at Ivy Tech. Other days I have these crazy ideas that I'm going to go cook at Standing Rock. That's kind of where all of this come from.
Well, now tell me a little bit about your work at Ivy Tech.
Yeah, so I'm the chef and catering manager of Courses Catering. So it's a student-run catering operation that we started in 2013 when I came on as staff there. We birthed that out of necessity. We've got a big, beautiful building at 2820 North Meridian. We had people that started to want to rent space there, and then they also wanted catering. And we thought, well, instead of outsourcing all of this, why don't we give our students in-house experience for an education, an actual hands-on education?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But now you came up through the program yourself, right?
I did, yeah. So I graduated from Ivy Tech. And then I started working there, so it's been really great.
Now, people might also have seen you at the local farmers market, right?
Yeah, so I also own a small business where I sell vegan and vegetarian soups and salads and hummus and pestos and all different. It's really kind of my creative outlet to what I want to personally make every week. And I used to grow microgreens, although I'm not doing that anymore. So.
So you have done a lot in the local food community. How do you see our food community right now? Is there a lot of interest in this sort of outreach kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that our local food community is just growing tremendously. I also am the SNAIL committee chair for Slow Food Indy, and I'm seeing this this whole where does my food come from? Who is the person that is growing my food? And people really wanting a connection with their food. And so I see consumers actually, you know, going to farmers markets, making that connection. And one of the beautiful things about organizations like Slow Food Indy is we connect people with their local food scene. So, you know, there's the Garfield Park Farmers Market that just came on this year. And Julia and Ashley have done a great job marketing that. But it doesn't matter how much marketing you do, you have to have people that want to go.
Exactly.
And we haven't seen any sacrifice. My booth is at the Broad Ripple Farmers Market. And, you know, people always speculate, well, I wonder if that will take away a consumer base,
right.
You know, but no, it didn't. It just completely added to the Indianapolis food scene. So I think there is plenty to go around.
Well, now tell me a little bit about the SNAIL of approval you mentioned
yeah.
and Slow Food Indy and what it does.
Well, Slow Food Indy has a mission of good, clean, and fair food. It's actually an international organization. We're just a small chapter here in Indianapolis. And what we aim to do is connect people with their food. So say a person walks up to us and says, we just don't know where to go. Like, what farmer grows their food? Or we don't know what kind of restaurants to support that have my values. And so, yeah, we have events. We do some supporting, like we supported the Garfield Park Farmers Market. We do things like that because we want to make sure that people are connected with the way their food is grown and it's ethically raised.
Now, tell me about how people can help you out with the GoFundMe effort or get involved in your efforts to feed people at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, thank you. So you can either friend me on Facebook. It's Anna Nicole Powell. Or you can check out my GoFundMe account, and it's called Cooking for Standing Rock.
We've been talking with Chef Anna Powell of Ivy Tech Community College. For more information on her Thanksgiving efforts to cook at Standing Rock, go to GoFundMe.com/Cooking for Standing Rock. You've got to love it when a local product gains a following. And when it gains a following that will stand outside for hours in the cold, waiting for it to be released, well, then you know you've really got something. And that's what's happened with one special mead that's released every year by New Day Craft, the Imperial Breakfast Magpie. It's a black raspberry mead infused with coffee and then aged in bourbon barrels, and it's only released once a year on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. Fans of the special mead will be standing in line for hours on November 25th to get their hands on a bottle, or maybe a case, of Imperial Breakfast Magpie. New Day's Tia Agnew tells us all about it. Okay, Tia, so it's that time of year again,
it
so
is.
I have to ask about Imperial Breakfast Magpie.
Yes, the big white whale that everybody seeks out
exactly.
and likes to trade all over the world. Yes, it's coming upon that time of year. The day after Thanksgiving, I believe it's November 25th this year.
All right, so forget about Black Friday shopping.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. You don't need to be shopping. Come hang out and drink with us. I mean, really, doesn't that sound like far more of a good time? But yeah, Imperial Breakfast Magpie, for those of you who are unindoctrinated, is our black raspberry and espresso mead. Everyone has heard of Breakfast Magpie. Well, this is the Imperial version of it, where it's not only higher ABV, but it's also been bourbon barrel aged.
Oh, my goodness. Now, this only comes out once a year, right?
It does. It comes out once a year, the day after Thanksgiving. We do a limit one case release per customer, and we have it on tap to enjoy by the glass in house. No growler fills.
Right. So tell me about how Imperial Breakfast Magpie came about and exactly what it is for people who might not be familiar with this This is very special local product.
Yeah, it sure is. The whole evolution of the Magpie line, I guess I can talk about that.
Right.
Many years ago, those of customers who know about us know we've been around. We're actually going on 11 years.
Oh my goodness.
We began just making mead moons and moons ago. And we made a still semi-sweet black raspberry that everybody really enjoyed. Well, it was more of a wine style. And when we moved to Fountain Square 6 years ago, we finally had kind of the breathing space and the ability to start experimenting with carbonated styles. We thought originally that was going to be a line extension, like, oh, we'd always do the still styles. Yeah, well, a few years after that, we immediately stopped the still lines, and we wanted to bring some of those flavor profiles over into the carbonated line.
From the wines that you used to do.
Yeah, exactly. Right. From those still meads that we used to make. Mm-hmm. And so we made one called the Magpie, which was the black raspberry, in a carbonated form, lower ABV, all that stuff. And so we were, we played with that. People enjoyed it, but we looked at what else creatively we could do with our flavors. And we kind of, Brett and I were sitting around going, you know, so I think espresso and black raspberry sounds really good together. Let's give it a shot. So for fun, we threw that in there, and then Breakfast Magpie was born, and people went crazy over it.
Now, why was that? What did they seize upon?
Well, I mean, as everybody says, I've never tasted anything like this before in my entire life. Which I'm like, that's pretty. That's a lot to say in the beer world,
right?
Because we're all doing crazy stuff. So we did the Breakfast Magpie. It was, got tons of love and still does.
Now, when did that come out?
That comes out usually every first or second weekend of December. So okay. We'll have the regular, quote unquote, Breakfast Magpie out in this December. And that'll be around for a few months. But with the Imperial, we wanted to, again, take it up a notch. What else? could we do? So, I'm like, bourbon. I really like bourbon. And let's put it in some bourbon barrels and see what happens. And we did that. And we thought, it'll be this fun little one-off, one-time thing we do. And of course, it went crazy. And we sold it out literally in 3 hours the first day.
The first year
we had it.
Was the first year?
I want to say, was it 3 years ago? 2 years ago? I'm old, Jillian. I won't say what my grandmother used to call this condition, but we're getting older. So the memory is a bit more like a sieve.
I'm guessing 3 years ago.
I think it was 3 years ago. Yeah. Well, if you include this year. Yeah, yeah. So we originally did it, and we had, gone. So last year, it lasted, to a few hours last year, more hours last year, because we released quite a bit more. But again, usually it'll stick around in-house for, like, just glass consumption, usually just over the weekend.
Oh, my goodness. So you'll be out of a weekend?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
The bottles will be gone that day. But, yeah, we have a few kegs out. So
now, tell me what it's like on that day, when people are waiting around to get this.
It's crazy. No, it's really great. I mean, I stand out there and I'm thinking, there'll be a few people that show up. Well, no, this as of last year, people started lining up at 7 a.m. We open at noon.
You open at noon? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I always go out there. I'm like, I want to hug everybody. You like it that much. It's very heartwarming, and I'm really excited about it. Because people have been now lining up so early, we are going to make sure we talked to our neighbor over at Susan, who does the Literally Divine Chocolates.
Literally Divine Chocolates.
Who took over Funk Yard.
That's right.
Yeah. She's
going to
be open for coffee. So we're going to try to figure out some, so people don't lose their place in line. We got to wait for everybody to get some coffee. We haven't secured anybody. We're trying to try to, we can get some donuts. Heck, even if Brett shows up with some Long's donuts to hand out, we'll have some kind of munchy food. But starting around noon, John with La Margarita, he's actually going to have their food truck there.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so normally you get, we know we have some small food items, but it's a little crazy for us to be making food that day.
Right.
So John's going to come out with his taco truck, and he's going to have some delicious options for people.
The day after Thanksgiving in Fountain Square,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, Fountain Square, right at the corner of Prospect and Shelby, New Day Craft. Come see us and hang out.
We've been talking with Tia Agnew of New Day Craft in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more from Tia and New Day here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with Tia Agnew of New Day Craft in Indianapolis, a producer of meads and hard ciders that have become very popular. We've talked about the upcoming release of New Day's Imperial Breakfast Magpie, but Tia also tells us more about the backstory on New Day Craft.
Tell me a little bit about the New Day Craft story, because, sure. You know, when it all started, when the magic started to happen.
Yeah. It was Brett and I joke, but Brett is my husband, by the way, for people who don't know. He is in charge of production. I'm in charge of everything else. That's just kind of the way it works. But we began, as I said, over 11 years ago. It was our answer to the brain drain. We were amateur mead makers. We were living outside where Brett grew up in the area of Frankton in Elwood, Indiana. And we were researching different ways we could actually stay in the state. We are from Indiana, both of us. We've lived and worked all over the United States. And we didn't want to have to move again. So we started our own business.
But you're a scientist,
yeah,
right?
Yep. Brett's a food scientist. So it's a little more linear path for him. With his focus has always been the beverage industry. I'm a scientist, too. I'm a wildlife biologist by degree, and then kind of went into the grant technical writing project management kind of arm of things. And so, you know, kind of that overall management, you know, work and, you know, profession that I had before serves us very well.
So when you decided to get into this, what was the motivation? Why mead?
Sure. Great question, because, you know, it's not, you know, like we're doing beer or traditional grape wine. Years and years ago, Brett and I, when we moved back to his family's farm, we started keeping bees for fun.
Yeah,
okay. We're total food nerds. And so we used to grow a lot of our own food and do a lot of other stuff, raise chickens for eggs, all sorts of stuff. He always wanted to keep bees. So we said, let's do this. Now, we don't do anything small. So instead of starting with one or two hives, we started with 10.
Oh, you just launched into the 10 hives?
Yeah, that's just how we work. Okay. And so we had a lot of honey at the end of the season.
Do you think, okay, I just have a lot of honey? I mean, how did you go from I've got a lot of honey to I'm going to make mead?
Sure. Well, you know, we went from we have a lot of honey to we've all this fruit that we grow on the farm and our neighbors do. And hey, you know, I've canned and I've made hot sauces, but hey, we've never made alcohol. Hey, let's make some booze because, you know, that's fun too. So the whole honey addition literally went, okay. Just to back it up, when you make a quote-unquote table wine, if you don't use grapes, if you use other fruits, which is what we had on hand, in order to get the alcohol content up to around a 12% ABV or higher, which is a quote-unquote table wine, you got to augment it with a sugar source.
Your sugar source.
Yeah. So we're like, all right, we got all this honey. Let's do this. And, you know, we want a dry product, so you got to have, you know, a little more honey to get to dry all this stuff. So we started making – we found out later was mead. We had no clue. When we were doing our research, we kind of we were looking at it, kind of saying, "Hey, we really like this hobby, and can we turn this into a business?"
And you did, apparently.
We did.
Now, how did that go? Because you started out as a winery, right?
Technically by permit, okay. Get a little technical on everybody. In the state, federally, there are three permits you can do. There's a winery permit, there is a brewery permit, and then there's, of course, a distiller's permit. There's nuances in and amongst that. But if you make mead and cider, you automatically fall into the winery permit category.
Oh.
Lots of legal stuff, okay. Lots of reasons. Basically, it comes down to we don't use grain. Hence,
oh, so you're not beer.
There's no cider or meadery permit in the United States.
Oh, so it has to go under the winery category.
Correct. Okay. So technically, even though we do not associate ourselves with wine, because you know, if you know our products, they're carbonated, they're in beer bottles, they're on tap, they're in kegs. We could definitely hang with the brewery. The brewery is really our colleagues. I mean, we love the winery roots we came from because it used to be more made like a table wine that kind of was a little more apples to apples. But since we've transitioned, we're rebranded as New Day Craft. You know, because we're a craft meat and cider company, kind of trying to align ourselves more so with, you know, the craft beer and cider drinker.
Now, that came from your customers, right?
Mm-hmm. It sure did, yeah. When I was explaining before, when we started doing the carbonated line as kind of like a line extension, after about a year, year and a half, we just looked at the numbers. We were selling literally 100 growler fills to one bottle of still product. It's like, okay, you know, as much as I loved my dry blueberry mead, it drank just like a French rosé. It was really great, you know, but, you know, you've got to take your personal likes and wants and you've got to look at what your customers want. You know, that's what business ownership is all about. Not to mention, I love my carbonated line, actually, even more so, I have to say, than the still line. But we just couldn't do both anymore. We had to, you know, we only have so much time, so many, you know, sure. man hours and resources that we said, okay, let's run with the carbonated line. We were been doing growler fills. Of course, we started bottling about a year and a half later after that. And we're now in Indiana, of course, Ohio, and we're looking to go into multiple other states in 2017.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So it was a good progression for you.
It has been. And a heck of a learning curve, let me tell you. You know, and that's part of being an entrepreneur. You know, you know, it's not just about it's a lot about learning and, you know, experimenting and listening to your customers and listening to what they want and, you know, being there for them and really making sure you're creating something that they really love and enjoy.
Now, tell me about the products, because, of course, Breakfast Magpie and Imperial Breakfast Magpie mm-hmm. are not the only things you make.
Right. There are headliners. That's what everybody, if you know about us, you've probably heard about those two or had those two. But yeah, we make both mead and cider. We do about, I'd say, in our rotation around 20 different varieties. Not all of those are in distribution. We have about 5 year rounds and, you know, then a handful of seasonals that we do in distribution. But in-house, like right now, I have 10 on tap. I have four ciders and I have 6 meads on tap right now. All our apples, I can tell you a little bit about ingredients. They all come from a family of growers up in northern Michigan. The cherries come from another set of growers in Michigan. You know, some of our other fruits we get from all over the country. Just depends on who's growing them. Our honey comes from a family of growers in the Midwestern wildflower honey. You know, so we really look for really high quality ingredients and we turn them into these great carbonated beer-like, cider-like products. Super approachable.
Approachable is interesting because the popularity of these sorts of products has just jumped lately.
Definitely.
And, you know, I think it must have something to do with the development, you know, and the growing popularity of craft beer. But mm-hmm. but it's different somehow, right?
Sure. I always say we're the peacemaker because my beer drinkers really dig our products and our wine drinkers find them very approachable.
Oh, no, that's interesting.
Yeah. Just as far as and it's also kind of our motto is to create a very well balanced product. Even with our barrel aged line, you might get some crazy flavors in there, but you're going to be able to taste everything and have a nice balance. Especially on the year round line, I want to make them, you know, really mass appealing, but in a good way. Not like, you know, they just taste like everything else that's out there. They don't like anything else that's out there. A lot of these don't. But they're really, really interesting and really approachable. So
what's been the most popular?
Oh, geez. I think rising popularity, the Shelby Blue Ribbon, that's our strawberry rhubarb mead.
Strawberry rhubarb
yeah.
mead.
People are like, what? I'm like, yeah, taste it. It's that good. It's really tasty. So it's taken off in the tasting room, but also in distribution. On my ciders, my South Cider is super popular, but we just released a couple months ago a hopped cider called She's Crafty.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, Beastie Boys fans, you know it. You know, so, you know, it's also a play on, you know, yes, women like craft, you know, hops as well. So it's a little tongue-in-cheek, you know, the female business owner that I am. I like to point out that yes, women dig hops too.
Right.
So that's kind of a little joke on that name there. That's super popular. On tap right now, we have a couple seasonal varieties we released, Paulding Light, a cranberry lime, Snapdragon. Yeah, some really crazy stuff. It's an apricot with a coriander, orange peel, and Halotau hops. Think of like a Belgian wit kind of, feel to it. Yeah, we really push the envelope. You know, I want stuff to, you know, have this, you know, beer-esque flavor profile, or I wanted to have like our Washington Spotlight taste like a cherry. Cherry hard cider. It's a cherry mead. It's cherries and honey, but it drinks like a hard cider. You know, we really try to play all over the flavor, the flavor spectrum.
Do you have things coming down the pipeline? Stuff new for next year?
Yeah, on 2017 actually. They're almost ready to roll. I have a bourbon barrel version of Johnny Chapman, which is our hard one of our hard apple ciders. It's a little bit richer one. It's going to be infused with molasses.
Oh,
so definitely a fun one. So really a nice little winter warmer beverage there. Of course, the Imperial's coming out very soon. But in 2017, we've got a few other R&Ds on the list I can't quite speak about just yet, but stuff that no one's ever had, you know, had from us before.
Right.
I won't say the flavors aren't somewhere out there in the beer, you know, lexicon. But, we're really looking to gear up and bring in pretty regularly some new products for us.
Well, now, what can people expect on Imperial Breakfast Magpie release day? You said that's November 25th?
Yep, it sure is. Yeah, that Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. The doors open at noon, and it's first come, first serve. We do not do a lottery or a ticket system, so y'all got to get in line. And like I said, last year people started lining up at 7 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
Bless them all. And so you're just going to get in line. The doors will open. We'll try to work through the line as fast as possible, where you'll get a one-case maximum. That's 12 bottles, 12 16.9-ounce bottles.
And how much are they?
And they're $15 each. So the bottles are $15 each. And, so cases, multiply that times 12. Jolene, I don't have my calculator in front of me.
too much math.
But, yeah, on that one, it's because it is such a high-demand product that we do not have a case discount on that one.
Well, all right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Jolene. We're super looking forward to it. Hopefully everybody can come out. And we'll have donuts and tacos and all sorts of good times.
We've been talking with Tia Agnew of New Day Craft, located in Fountain Square in Indianapolis. For more information on Imperial Breakfast Magpie and all the other New Day releases, go to newdaycraft.com or look for it on Facebook. So it has been 2 years since Eat, Drink, Indie Radio debuted on WFYI, and in that 2 years we have been in the kitchen cooking with lots of local chefs. The idea for our Cook This segments is that chefs agree to be surprised by an ingredient that I bring, and then to create a dish with it, and to tell us about their thought processes along the way. We've cooked in restaurants and home kitchens, but for the very first Cook This, Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar cooked a pork chop in his pizza oven. Here's how it all happened.
You know, this is a sort of a robust meal, right? When I think of a pork chop, I don't think of... you could make this an appetizer for two people, but I think in terms of, like, a meal. But I don't know. Today, I think I'm going to... Because it's lunch, I think I'm going to do something probably a little bit lighter, and I'll probably... Just do a little bit. We're going to roast it in the wood oven, of course, because we have access to a wood oven. Why wouldn't you? And so I'll probably roast it off really well in the wood oven, get some nice color on it. And I'll probably just do like a little salad with it just to lighten it up, because it's meat. And meat, typically for me in the middle of the day, is I don't really try not to eat a lot of meat in the middle of the day. And I think a lot of people are the same way. It kind of weighs you down. Your body has a little bit harder time digesting it. And so... So, yeah, just to lighten it up a little bit, and so probably just roast it off, make a nice little salad with it.
What kind of flavors do you think about? Does it matter what time of year it is, or like you said, what time of day it is?
Well, it definitely matters what time of day it is. What time of year, of course, that weighs on the ingredients that you have to use. If this were dinner time, I would be thinking about probably some squash with it at this time of year. I would be thinking about maybe, I would start to think more in terms of what to accompany with it. I don't work with spices a whole bunch. So my proteins tend to be pretty straightforward, salt and pepper. I don't use curry, I don't curry things, and although I love curry, but I tend not to do that. I tend to just kind of try to let that really great product sort of just do its thing, right? So the time of year is just going to dictate the accoutrement, right? I'll see what we have laying around, basically, But I don't want to do anything too heavy. That's the key here, because you got this really beautiful piece of meat, and get great color on it, and make it just super flavorful, and then just accompany it with a really nice little salad, and try and keep it really light. That would be my sort of goal for this thing. Because we're at Pizzology, I'm sort of we've got Italian ingredients.
Well, you have a certain palette that you're working with.
That's exactly right. We have a certain sort of, cadre of ingredients, and that's what I will use. So that's kind of what I've been thinking of in terms of what this would be. And I guessed you were going to bring me a pork chop.
Okay, why
I had no idea. I don't know. I totally, it was a total guess. I was like, I don't know what she's going to bring.
But see, I thought pork chop is too easy. Is it too easy?
It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy.
But it's something real that people would actually cook.
I hope I don't mess this up. yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
They would actually cook a pork chop.
They should.
Why not?
If they're not, they're crazy. I mean, this thing's beautiful too. This is a gorgeous pork chop.
So there you go. You got a 12-ounce pork chop, and it kind of has a little bit.
And honestly,
nice,
I mean, you know, for lunch, you could feed 3 people for lunch with this thing.
Oh, I know.
But for dinner, you know, this, not for me. I would want my own. But I mean, a couple people, you could feed, you know, 2 people with this pork chop for dinner.
I was trying to decide if I've ever seen pork chop on one of your menus.
Yeah. We had pork chops at L'Explorateur. We did a pork chop very early on at Libertine, which we took off very quickly because the price point was too high. We didn't want to do it anymore. But yeah, I love them. It's been a long time since I've got to cook with one.
So just salt?
Yeah, salt, and I'll get a pepper grinder here in a second, and I'll get some pepper on it too. But I'm kind of, you can see I'm pretty aggressively seasoning it because it's going to sit for a few. And I probably won't season it. Obviously, I won't season it again before it goes in the oven. Nobody's going to learn anything from just seasoning a pork chop, right? Maybe. It'll be delicious, though.
Well, it will.
I think I'm going to do maybe, I think just a little sort of accompaniment with it. I think I'm going to do burrata.
What's that?
Just do a little fresh-made burrata.
Oh, sure.
So just stretch a little bit of mozzarella. Put a little ricotta inside of it. Great with a salad. Great with a few little slices of pork. Again, Italian palate, so it's kind of what I have. So we're going to set this off to the side. And I'm going to run and get a couple bowls. I'm going to get a pot of water on to stretch my burrata. Get some ricotta to stuff the burrata with. And then we'll be working on a sauce, too.
Okay.
I'm probably going to put pesto inside of the burrata so that when you break open the burrata, you'll have a little pesto and a little bit of the curd.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, so it'll go with that pork and the dressing and the salad too. So I'm just going to put the ricotta inside and we'll put a couple little dollops of the pesto inside so that when you break it all open, it gets all like, you know, lovey-lovey. While it's cooling, it affords us the time to sort of do this.
So now, how hot is that oven?
Right now, it's 730 degrees. If you take a pizza stone up slowly on a grill, you could achieve this very same effect.
I could recreate this, almost.
Yeah. You know? No, you could. You totally could. And you could get, you know, this great color on it.
It's looking beautiful, though.
No, it looks great, yeah. When it's finished, we'll just take it out. We'll let it rest for probably 5 minutes or so. We'll slice it, have a little salad, and a little burrata.
Looks beautiful. Oh, my God, it smells so good.
Yeah, the eye feels fantastic. So just going to take a little arugula, of course, a little salt, a little pepper. So this thing should be somewhat ready. Oh, yeah, you can see how the...
Show me what you're looking at.
Well, there's a beautiful, clear liquid coming up out of the surface of the meat.
Right.
That's a great sign. You can also, if you touch it, it's not so hot that you can't leave your finger on it. And coming out of a almost 800-degree oven, that's saying something. That means that the heat has gone into the center of the meat. And so the juices are starting to come out, and it's starting to settle down a little bit. It could probably rest a little bit longer, but we're going to go for it. So you can see, I did not indeed overcook it. Still got a nice sort of pink medium center, which I like. So you can see. Go ahead.
Beautiful. Oh, my goodness.
Let's make sure it's okay before we compose the dish.
It's really, really good.
Right?
Wow. And what would you call it? What would you call a dish like that?
I would just, you know, a roasted pork chop and with a salad, a burrata salad, really. I mean, that's what it is.
We've been talking and cooking with Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar. For more information on Neil and his restaurants, go to neilbrownhospitality.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio to hear about how the first year at a new farmer's market turned out. I talked with Garfield Park Farmer's Market co-founders Ashley Brooks and Julia Woody back in the spring, right before the launch of their new market. And then I checked in just this past week with Ashley to find out how that first season turned out and what's planned for next year.
We just ended our first season in October, with May through October, and we're obviously so pleased with it. It went really well, and yeah, we can't wait to start planning for year two.
So what were some of the challenges that you expected to find, and did it turn out that way, or was it surprising? Was it as expected? How did that go?
Well, there were definitely a lot of surprises, as you can imagine. A lot of inclement weather, and we had to kind of navigate that. One of the biggest challenges that we foresaw was, how to get enough customers, right, and how to get the word out. And I think we did a really good job of accomplishing that. We had a huge support from the neighborhood and people that live in the area. So they would come out every week, and we had regulars every single week, rain or shine. So that was really great, and that was really motivating throughout the season.
Were there any other surprises along the way?
Not really. I mean, it was we were surprisingly successful, and I think it's always hard to sort of manage all of these moving pieces, right? So, you're trying to, our market master, Julia Woody, she did an amazing job of managing and sort of juggling the vendors, and coordinating all of that every week. And also the volunteers, and just getting everything sort of in place to make it successful. So kudos to her for doing such a wonderful job this year.
Now, how do you do it, though? How did you start and create the idea of, okay, we want a farmer's market, and we're going to have one, and then you just did it?
Well, so Julia and I were on the board of Slow Food Indy together, and so we just started these conversations then, and then it was roughly 3 years ago, we both had found ourselves living in Garfield Park with our little ones and, just starting families, and so we just kind of realized that there was no better time to start something like this, no better place, and that there was really just a need for it in that part of town.
So now tell me a little bit about the need for it in that area. We hear a lot about, food deserts and the idea of bringing, fresh food to areas that might not have it. So it was a fair ways to get to another farmer's market from there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just kind of both got tired of traveling so far to get to a market on a Saturday morning. It's great having the Wednesday market downtown. It's great having the Irvington market once a month. But I think that, sort of nostalgic, Saturday morning market just, we just wanted something closer to us. So it was a little bit selfish. And certainly in that part of town, I think downtown there was really, it was just hard to have access to that kind of product and what we have high standards for ourselves. So anyways, it was, we just saw a need for it. And
well, now what kind of market did you envision, and did that happen? Tell me a little bit about the type of market it is.
Yeah. So we really wanted to start small, just to kind of, wrap our minds around the concept and just kind of feel it out the first year. So we intended for it to be a little bit smaller. We could have added more vendors, but we felt like the customer base just wasn't quite there enough. So we wanted it to be worth it for the vendors and the farmers, worth it for the customers. And so that was a fine balance to keep. And we knew that it would expand the following, years. So we definitely, there were a few principles that we hold tried and true, slow food values. So good, clean, and fair food for all, sustainability and organic if possible. And so we had we developed a pretty rigorous, application and vetting process, which I think is really wonderful.
It's a grower only market?
Yeah. So producer only, growers only. And that was kind of the number one, most important factor for us. I think, Julia has a huge farming background, and I have a background in the food industry and restaurant industry. So both of us combined, I think, you know, we know our farmers personally. And so that's a really good place to start. You know, we've actually visited all the farms over the season. We've done farm visits for every single vendor, or site visits. So that vetting process was really important to us. And, yeah, so I think just a combination of our contacts and, you know, our experience in the industries.
Now, how was the reaction from the neighborhood, and from the park?
The neighborhood loved it, obviously. You know, most people that came, I think, just walked over, or, you know, every single week throughout the season, we had, till the very end, people just walking by saying, I never knew this existed. I just saw there were people over there and came over. So that was really kind of fun to see. So the neighborhood got really, really involved, and we had this amazing base of volunteers. Every week they were coming and, you know, just hanging out and directing traffic and collecting trash and just talking with customers and, you know, playing with the kids and stuff. So it was really a really, really warm kind of feeling and a community feeling that I think it's something that we had talked about a lot, Julia and I and the board in general. We have a great board. And that's something that we really wanted to bring, you know, that experience, but weren't, you know, quite sure how that was going to come about, but we just were confident that it was, and it ended up happening. So, and the park was amazing too, that the Parks Department, really great to work with, and, you know, they had their processes. It took a while, but they were really happy to have us. So
how long did it really take from idea, from conception to, you know, your first day of the market?
Yeah, I think really, really sitting down and having regular meetings with, you know, Julia, and that was probably 2 years before we opened. And we got our board together and had regular meetings then. And then I think, you know, it took a good year of really, really, like, boots to the ground planning. So,
were there some things that that you would change? Anything you would do differently? Any you know, things like, you know, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, you know, Julie and I and the whole board, like this, you know, we have other things going on in life. Life's pretty crazy and things, you know, things come up. And so we've all been really dedicated to the cause, despite having, you know, life changes and jobs and career changes and all these things. And so I'm really happy with that, you know, to have such a dedicated group of people in that community. So I just think, yeah, it's just really, like, it takes a village for sure. So we also want to support our local farms, too, that are also trying to expand. So Big City Farms and South Circle Farm, one of our most popular vendors this year, they do amazing things. They're in town. They're, you know, they both exist within a five-mile radius of the market. And they actually have a barn raiser that they're doing right now online. They're trying to raise money to build greenhouses and expand their product. So,
oh, that's very cool. Now people can support that?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just kind of like crowdfunding. It's called Barn Raiser. And you can go online and then search for South Circle Farm or Big City. And yeah, so they're trying to raise some money and bring more and better product to you guys.
You recently wrapped up the first year. You'll be back in the spring. When do you start up again, and what do you do in the off season to like regroup?
Yeah, so we'll just start meeting again and planning and, you know, discussing what worked for us this year, what didn't work. We'll kind of go over all of the data we've collected and then really sort of, you know, re-envision and hone in on new marketing techniques and new partnerships and stuff like that. I think we really want to improve on sponsorships, you know, partnering with local organizations, which you did a good job of this year, but there's always more, you know, room for that. And so, yeah, we'll start, you know, talking about fundraising and grants going forward. And so.
Now, when does it start up again? Is it early? Is it one of the very early starting markets?
So we'll start in May again, and then around January we'll start releasing the applications and start that whole process. So, yeah, we'll have about 6 months to really plan, you know, the next year, and then it'll just be full steam ahead.
So do you have any advice for people who might be thinking about something like this, you know, starting maybe, you know, if not a market, you know, something in the community? I feel like we have a very active local food community that does so many cool things. Any advice?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, the group of us that started this, we were very active in the food community and care a lot about food access. We saw a need for it in our neighborhood. And I think that's really the motivating factor is, you know, I mean, you have to make a place. If you want something to be better, you have to just kind of enact that yourself a lot of times. So I think that if you live somewhere where you just don't feel like you have good options, you know, start going to community meetings, join your neighborhood, you know, board or organization, and just start talking to people and find out if it's possible, find out who wants to be involved, because like I said, it, you know, it's not just one or two people. It takes a lot of people and a lot of commitment.
Are you optimistic about Indianapolis and what's going on with food here?
I am. I'm an eternal optimist. So despite what's happened this week and the recent election results, yeah, so I always want to remain optimistic, especially when it's something I care about with food and industry. And not only just the thriving, you know, economy of that, but it's the people that are involved too. I mean, that's what it kind of comes down to for me is, you know, these people that work hard every day and make it happen and giving them opportunities and making connections with that.
We've been talking with Ashley Brooks, co-founder of the Garfield Park Farmers Market. For more information on the market, look for it on Facebook or go to GarfieldParkFarmersMarket.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our second anniversary program, and thanks also to our guests. Anna Powell of Ivy Tech Community College, Tia Agnew of New Day Craft, Ashley Brooks of the Garfield Park Farmers Market, and Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.